This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear from an avant-garde composer performing on the Central Coast this week who is challenging long-held ideas of what classical music can be.
Think about the idea of classical music. Why is it just Western European classical music as the classical music of the world?
Also, it's pomegranate season on the Central Coast. We'll hear about all the great recipes you can use the fruit in, but also the labor of love that goes into growing it.
Well, it starts out as a beautiful flower, red flower. It has to be pollinated, and then it will start to grow into a little green pod that gets bigger and bigger, and then once it gets to the right size, it will start to turn red.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, October 28th, 2019. I'm Tyler Pratt. Before we begin today's show, many parts of California are currently dealing with wildfires, evacuations, and power shutoffs. Much of the Central Coast remained in the clear last week, but with more hot, dry conditions in the forecast for much of the state, conditions can always change in an instant. Stay safe out there, and KCBX News will keep you up to date over at kcbx.org. Now let's take a drive up Highway 1 to Big Sur. It's hard to miss the tall rock with the lighthouse jutting out into the ocean. For decades, people have been able to tour this historic Point Sur Light Station. But next door, there's an old military facility that has been off limits to the public until now. The historic naval facility played a key role in the Cold War. Eric Mahoney of KAZU News in Monterey got a tour.
The entrance to the facility is marked with a wooden sign on Highway 1. Etched in white paint, it reads Point Sur Naval Facility. From there, a gate opens up to a road that stretches toward the Pacific Ocean. On both sides are old buildings, a mess hall, a weapons bunker, a steam plant. The facility was built in 1957. Volunteer historian Carol O'Neill stands in the roadway, wearing an official bright yellow jacket. Sewn onto the jacket is the Naval Facility's fake logo, a seahorse in the center of a triangle.
This was hidden in plain sight.
To keep the facility secret, its cover was an oceanographic research station. But that's not what actually happened here. Instead, the Navy was listening for Soviet submarines during the Cold War.
Soviets did not know that we could do this. And for years, they made really loud submarines.
This site was one in a chain of about 30 underwater listening posts around the world that were tasked with this top secret mission. They were all part of SOSIS, which stands for Sound Surveillance System. O'Neill walks down the main road toward the listening building.
So this is the T building, and this is where I'll say the magic happens, and you'll notice there are no windows.
She peers through a rusty metal gate that surrounds the beige building with peeling paint. A guard shack still stands nearby. O'Neill says underwater cables extended from this building out into the ocean, and attached to these cables were hydrophones, or underwater microphones that captured sound.
The sound was written essentially on a graph, and analysts would look at it and say, oh, that's a whale, that's a freighter, that's a trawler. Oh, that's a Soviet submarine.
O'Neill doesn't know how many submarines they heard. Even today, when she has talked with people who worked at the naval facility, they don't divulge all of the details.
And when people talk to us who were stationed here, oh, I wish I could tell you about that, and then they don't. But it's very much the Tom Clancy Cold War spy versus spy stuff.
The facility operated from 1958 to 1984. It closed for a few reasons. For one, a lot of the operations were relocated. But also because O'Neill says a spy leaked the secret.
The spy, John Walker, who was a retired Navy warrant officer, essentially spilled the beans and told the Soviets that we could hear their submarines.
In the year 2000, the federal government transferred all but one building to California State Parks, with the condition it would eventually be open to the public. State Parks made it part of the Point Sur State Historic Park, which includes the next-door light station. Finally, this January, volunteers began getting the naval facility into shape for public visits.
Get rid of the graffiti and replace some windows.
Volunteer Joe DeSante is working to replace a door that rotted out.
Make it so the public can see what was happening here.
The first ever walking tours began this October. So far, people can only go into one building. Safety improvements and painting will continue into the future to open more. The point isn't to make these buildings look new, but to show what it looked like back in the day. Part of the challenge is deciding what day, since it operated for decades. The facility has been nominated for the National Register of Historic Places. O'Neill says there are several reasons to come and visit the Point Sur Naval Facility, one being to learn about the past and the people who worked here.
It's important for the Cold Warriors to know that they are valued and their stories are out there because we had heroes in the Cold War.
A secretive past on the Big Sur coastline, now ready to be revealed. Erica Mahoney, KAZU News.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by a local author and probably of many future works too, Jack Cameron. Welcome.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
So glad to be here. I love, as a former librarian and avid reader, I love interviewing authors of any sort, but especially local authors who have ties to our area. And often, I think, as it happens with this novel, a lot of the local stuff, the culture, the vibrations, the weather is part of the narrative, right?
Absolutely true. My novel, The Storm Drain Murder, is set in a little town very much like Cambria. And the locale and the weather and the whole atmosphere blend into the story.
Awesome. Looking forward to talking about the novel as well as your thoughts about becoming an author, a published author. But first and foremost, I'd like to get to know you a little bit better, sort of who you are, where you come from, and how you got to today.
Sure. I'm a retired lawyer. I grew up in the Midwest. I practiced in the Midwest and the East Coast. And eventually I moved to California. I worked in Sacramento for the state of California for 20 years. I retired. And now I finally have time to write things that I want instead of responding to the issue or the crisis of the moment.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about your novel, how that got started and how you chose the particular plot and theme.
Well, unfortunately, I had an operation and I wasn't able to do much. Now, I wouldn't recommend that approach to everybody. I used to do some of my best thinking when I was commuting. But I had a lot of time on my hands, and I spent a lot of time walking around Cambria. And I thought, gee, this would be a really great place to set a novel. And I started thinking about people I've known and experiences I've had over the years. And the characters began to form in my head. And there is a storm drain in town, and the idea came to me, wouldn't it be something if somebody dumped a body into the storm drain? And then I thought, gee, what if I grew up here? What if I had grown up in Cambria and I knew the people here? And I started to develop the characters that way also. So it just kind of all came together. And some people, when they begin to write, they write out an outline, a very detailed outline of everything they want to cover, all the plot points and the characters. And some people who are called pantsers, P-A-N-T-S-E-R-S, just start writing. And I was kind of a combination of both. I had the ideas in my head, and as a lawyer, I've always had to be pretty organized. So I was able to basically begin writing with a clear picture of where I wanted to end up.
What gave you the idea of writing a mystery? Is there a particular author you like or genre you like? Or tell me about that.
Well, I am a fan of mysteries. I really like the Michael Connelly books, Harry Bosch Mickey Halloran, mm-hmm. And David Robichaux, so I've been a fan of that genre. Now, my novel doesn't approach their level of knowledge of crime and that sort of thing, but I think it's a very compelling mystery. Writer's Digest says it's a fun and gripping read, and it grabs the reader in the first chapter and doesn't let go. So I think I accomplished that. And I just wanted to write an intriguing story with lots of twists and turns in the plot and a few red herrings thrown in. I mean, there are at least three suspects as the murderer, mm-hmm. And wanted to leave it at the end where you thought you knew what was going to happen, but there's room for a sequel. I don't like books or movies where the end is so neatly tied up that there's nothing left to think about. A friend of mine read the book and said, gee, the ending kind of left me hanging. And I wrote back and I said, that's absolutely the point.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that maybe things like, I'm going to say maybe a cookbook. You want the recipe to turn out right and clear and tasty. But most good fiction is... Once you end with a question rather than a resolution to keep your interest, not only in a sequel, but just to wonder. I think it makes you want to go back to the text and maybe find out where you were duped, the reader.
Well, I don't think I duped anybody, but I did leave a question at the end. And people have told me they've read the book twice just so they're sure they understand exactly what they think is going to happen next.
Well, that's quite a compliment. Is there a craft to writing mysteries versus, because you've written short stories as well, is there a craft to that golden rules you follow?
You know, there are an awful lot of rules, and I pay more attention to the conventions. For example, people say that you should never change point of view in the middle of a paragraph or in the middle of a chapter. But some of the best books I've ever read have broken those rules, and they're very compelling. Cutting for Stone is one of those books where it's all first person omniscient, except when it's not, and it's just. But it's a terrific book. So you observe good grammar when that's appropriate. You try to be clear in your expression. You want to add tension. You want the characters to be interesting, but you don't want to over describe them. Hemingway once described two characters as a man in a white suit and a woman in a hat, and the only attribute he attributes to the woman is she takes off her hat, and yet the dialogue and the way they move give you a complete picture of who they are.
Right.
And I've tried to do that in my story also.
I've always felt that the masters of dialogue, unadorned or not over-adorned, let's say, by plot and setting, are gripping. Elmore Leonard comes to mind.
Oh, yes, exactly.
One of the classics. I don't know how he does it, but wow.
Yes, absolutely.
This is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author Jack Cameron. We're discussing his new mystery novel, The Storm Drain Murder, and also the craft of writing, in particular mysteries. When you think about writing another book that's coming up, how do you set the stage for yourself mentally or do's and don'ts in that process?
Again, for me, it occurs to me when I'm doing something else. I've done some of my best writing when I'm either driving or walking or washing the dishes. The ideas come and then you think about them, refine them in your head. And eventually you get to the point where you can start putting them on paper. Now, writers say that their characters talk to them. And it's absolutely true. When I've written a scene and one of my characters has said or done something, that will spark other ideas for what the character or the other people in the scene may do next. So it's kind of an organic process.
Well, how about for people who want to get into the field of writing and not be discouraged, some advice, some tips that you might have?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to just put your preconceptions aside. Hemingway calls the blank page the white bull, the blank page or the blank computer screen. And what you need to do is get an idea in your head and then just sit down and start doing it. Write the first sentence, write the first paragraph, write the first page, and see where that leads you. I think it's very important to get feedback, and your family is fine, but it's so much better to get feedback from a group. Like in San Luis, there are the slow night writers.
Mm-hmm.
In Cambria, there are the rough writers, as I've said, and the writer's workshop. The Night Riders down here in San Luis have chapters all over. It's just really important to get feedback from other people and listen to what they say. And if it resonates, then follow their suggestions.
I assume also you would, to me, a good novel is one that is well-researched, detail. And so either you've done that or been there as the author, or you, let's say you go and talk with the specialist at the police department. If it's an art book about a fire, you'd go talk to the arson inspector and pick their brains.
Right, and I did do quite a bit of research when you get into the book on the various crimes that one of the suspects is charged with, and my protagonist, Jason, is able to look at the charging document and say, oh, this is the theory of the case. They think you kidnapped him first before you dumped him into the storm drain, and that may or may not be true, but judging by the list of penal code violations that are listed on the charging document, he can make that assessment of what the police think the case is all about.
So what is your strategy to not only write the book, but to get it known and read?
Well, these days you have to promote yourself. I'm a self-published author. I'm proud to be a self-published author. I think that my book shows a great amount of quality and production values. So you have to do things like an interview like this. You have to do social media. You have to do book signings. You have to do readings. I had a book signing at Barnes & Noble on July 20th. And Barnes & Noble bought some copies of my book to put on their shelves. I think that's terrific.
Nice.
It's available also on Amazon and Kindle, and as long as I'm talking about it, at Lynn's in Cambria, Lynn's Homestyle, and at the Coalesce Bookstore in Morro Bay, and at the San Simeon Lodge store in Mart. So you have to do things, go out there and make it known. A friend of mine said this morning when I told her I was going to be doing this interview, she said, well, people won't know you're out there unless you tell them you're out there. And that's right. Absolutely true.
Right. I think there's lots of myths in the world today. But one of them is that people are writing less, reading less. Studies, in fact, show that's not the case. I also happen to know from a psychological point of view, being a psych major at Berkeley back in the day, that the internet is good for certain things like fact finding. There, if we can find the fact and the treasure. But reading a book is a different experience and much more engaging than, say, a movie. And old-time radio, which includes, for my money, the idea of listening to a book as well, audio performance of art as well as reading a book are both incomplete works of art. What's missing is the listener or the reader. And when those two things are connected, there's a spark that goes off. There's an engagement that it's not only entertaining, but I think it's healthy from a mental health point of view.
There is nothing like holding a book in your hands and reading the printed page. It's just the most marvelous experience. And I'll tell you that when I did my book signing at Barnes & Noble, it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was amazed at the number of families who came in with their kids into the bookstore with kids, and the number of people who walked out with three or four books under their arm. I was just so gratified that people are still that into reading.
Well, you know, the novel, which in French means new, that's all it means, came about pretty much in the early 1700s, although there was an earlier Catalan one back in the 1400s. But we're basically talking about a story with a particularly long narrative. And so I'm convinced that people, their taste, their neuroplasticity had to adapt to a longer narrative. They had to read to a certain point, put in a bookmark, and then come back to it. One of my biggest concern now with the shortening attention span and so forth is that is limiting people's comprehension, their interest in things. And I'm hoping the novel will stay a vibrant part of our mental landscape.
Well, and that's why it's important when you write to write something that a person can't put down.
And there you go.
And I would like to think that, in fact, people have told me my book is that way. They say, oh, my God, I should be doing the dishes, but I'm reading my book.
Wow.
Reading The Storm Drain Murder instead. So I think if the quality of writing is there, then people can learn to bookmark it and come back to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. As we wind up our discussion, what would be one or two concepts that you want people to take away to remember after this moment?
Well, I think people should realize that if they are interested in creative writing, they just, as I said earlier, they just need to sit down, face the blank page, and start doing it. Especially as people reach retirement age and they wonder what they're going to do to fill their time, it's just a fabulous way to use your creative energy. And the other thing is, I would like people to remember the title of my book, The Storm Drain Murder.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by local author Jack Cameron, discussing the craft of authorship, mysteries in particular, but also his brand new novel, The Storm Drain Murders. And I have begun it, and I'm excited. I could barely put it down myself. I encourage you to take a look yourselves at a local library or a local bookstore, indie or not. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Brian. It was a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Tyler Pratt. An avant-garde hip-hop orchestra from Oakland will be performing in Santa Barbara this week as part of UCSB's Arts and Lectures series. On Friday, Meek Nawoosh will showcase their seven-piece chamber orchestra, Rap and Dancing, that challenges global conversations not just about what music can be, but who we are as a society. 41-year-old Juwon Kim is the composer and pianist behind the movement. I spoke with him recently to learn more about how he got started, his inspiration, and what all goes into his shows.
Talking about soul, talking about gold. You know my style flow like the now go, yo. This could be the last round found round the crows. Labor to leave a legacy found in these pros. The mark on how I rose. Let the record show I took the blows and did it my way. Old brown eyes, a visionary or so I say. The game colder than the ice age. Keep me open 24 hours just like a Rite Aid. This could be the last
time. So I grew up in South Korea, and then I've always was interested in classical music because, you know, for me, growing up there, classical music was actually new. And for a lot of Asians, it's like a new thing. And then once I got to the States and I realized that it's an old stuff, which was fine to a point, but then the direction that I was not forced to, but, you know, you're studying these kind of aesthetics to go to this direction of, like, creating new language of music wasn't something that I was interested in because I realized that it wasn't working with the modern audience. It was in my graduate studies, I wanted to find an answer to get out of this crazy world of concert music, and I found it in hip-hop, and I did a novelty piece that pissed off a lot of teachers, but then we ended up getting a full-page write-up on Oakland Tribune, which puzzled me. Then my MC at the time suggested that we make an album. I wrote about an hour of music next 6 months, and I had to seriously think about what I did as a composer because I thought of myself as a serious composer, and I still think of myself as a serious composer. But then, you know, as I was going deeper into the hip-hop, I found NWA, and that was the moment that I felt like I was almost dipped into the river of hip-hop and then reborn as a hip-hop composer.
First of all, tell me what it was about NWA that really sat with you and stayed with you.
Yeah, so it was the track After Police.
After Police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad because I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority.
And I felt the audacity and the kind of things that they were saying. It was the energy that the piece had. So because I think that the music works to people, not because it's technically sound, but because it can move you in some ways. Hip hop still does have this kind of raw sort of primordial power, which at first jazz had, but now it became more institutionalized. So I tapped into that with that piece, and I felt like, wow, you can say this, like, you've said it when this, you know, people weren't even talking about police brutality. It was like a raw sort of expression of middle finger to the establishment, and I was really taken with that because, you know, I've been always the one that did something completely off of my own sort of cultural background and what I was supposed to do, and I would always go against it. So I really bought into that.
So you talked about that middle finger to the establishment, which sounds like happened to you when you were in school. You said your professors didn't like the piece that you created, but then you ended up getting in a newspaper, the Oakland Tribune. Tell me about what happened there and how that shifted things for you.
So that kind of opened up sort of a possibility of this working for an audience who actually liked concert music. And I still feel like I'm in the realm of concert music. But the problem with concert music isn't necessarily that public isn't educated. The problem is actually a software problem. We have infrastructure that is excellent. The orchestras are great. And, you know, it's comparable to the European orchestras. But the issue is that we don't have programs or aesthetics that public can actually latch onto. Because the whole idea of concert music now is to sort of push the musical language forward, and then it would actually have to be, since 1960s, they wanted to get, you know, sort of get rid of and completely deconstruct the ones that we used to practice. In technical term, it's called common practice period, which is 17th century to early 20th century. They wanted to do completely different kind of thing. And then people went into these different directions, and thinking that people like Britney Spears or, you know, whoever is famous now, singing in 12-tone melodies. And it was such a crazy, delusional, modernist dream that failed. But, you know, academics are still holding on to it. And I was like, okay, you know what? I am not in there. I'm not, you know, this is not my classical music. And also, think about the idea of classical music. Why is it just Western European classical music as the classical music of the world? And also I was thinking about, okay, some guy in Malaysia playing the violin, the best, you know, representation or the career goal, final goal would be playing in Berlin Philharmonic. That is absurd to me. And because the world has become very complex, and then the emergence of black music in America changed a lot. And it is actually false idea that we are kind of still believing in, like some weird religion, like weird cult, that the only legitimate music is coming out of the European canon and thinking, and the music that has been subsequently built upon this idea. And I am violently against it, which is why probably I connected with hip-hop, because that's like basically building from something very simple from the bottom up. And then now look at Kendrick Lamar getting Pulitzer, because the rhyming and then the music, the relationship of that, it is completely new. It is a modern invention. It is also very American. And I felt really good about that.
How much a dollar really costs? The question is detrimental, paralyzed in my thoughts. Parasites in my stomach keep me with a gut feeling, y'all. Gotta see how I'm chilling once I park this luxury car.
Yeah, we played a bunch of different places. For instance, we went to Apollo Music Cafe. New Yorkers love it, actually. Whenever we go there, we would sell out. Apollo Music Cafe was the first time when we actually played in the city. It is a smaller, I think, 250-seater in Apollo Theater. We sold out. And they didn't even know us, and then they loved it. And then we did play at some really dingy clubs in the beginning stage of our career. Not that we're like really well known, but like in the very beginning shows in the Bay Area, they just didn't know what to do with us. And, you know, outdoor festivals. We played everywhere, any and everywhere. We headlined this outdoor festival in Hong Kong, where there were about 2,000 people plus, called Free Space Happening. And we were invited by West Kowloon government. And that happened in March. And before that, we went to Vassar College in New York to headline their ModFest, which is a very prestigious contemporary new music festival.
Now, your crew has about 10 people in it with instruments such as the flute, clarinet, violin. You have an MC. How did you all come to find each other?
Well, MCs I had one initial MC, Kirby, and then sort of I became infamous in the area. Like this guy, this Juwan guy, everybody at first thought that I was like you know, Shaquille O'Neal looking dude, and then they got super disappointed whenever they saw this Asian guy with long hair who had no idea what hip hop was. And then, but they really enjoyed working with us because the idea is very fresh, and simply this has never been done. And there are some acts that's out there that are doing something like this, but it wasn't to this extent, and it wasn't to this kind of like larger scale. And we've been doing this for 9 years, and we've been incrementally developing this language. Now finally we have this sort of what we call like musical sort of actual language that we are using that is uniquely us. So the other players that are largely based in San Francisco Conservatory player pool, because I went there, and I was also very infamous for doing crazy stuff. So that's how I found these people.
And you also say your crew also has an occasional turf dancer. What's that?
Turf dancing is a form of street dance that was developed in Oakland, and they have method sample ballet and different kind of contortion and dislocating shoulders and stuff like that. It's a very graceful dance style, and it can be descriptive. They do this kind of hand gestures that tells a story. And we have a great crew called Turf Inc. and Turfanes, and we're currently working with this young up-and-coming young talent named Young Phil. And he had worked with a bunch of different people, YG and some other trap rappers that are questionable to me, but very famous. So he's...
Now, when you travel to different cities, do you collaborate with musicians in those cities? Do they ever join you on stage?
Yes. So in Hong Kong, we went with our core crew, MC, and then a drummer that I trust, and our executive director. And all of the musicians were from Hong Kong New Music Ensemble and or some other freelance people. They were very high-level classical musicians. And then we sourced them. And then a very famous Hong Kong MC called MC Yan of LMF, which is a crew that is that has been in Hong Kong for a long, long time. They're like the godfathers of hip-hop. So we did that. And then we have a project that we are doing with American River College Orchestra on December 4th. And we are blowing up all our music to 70-piece symphony orchestra, and we're using their symphony as well as our crew.
Wow. Okay. So y'all will be coming to the Central Coast at the end of October and the beginning of November for a performance at UCSB Arts and Lectures on November 1st. What can people expect from your show?
You will see diverse backgrounds of people coming to one stage and creating music that is accessible, rigorous, and new at the same time. And you will see that actually the best of America is still happening, and it is still the best country in the world.
And you'll also be hosting an educational workshop on the 30th. For people that want to attend that, what can they expect to learn?
We will be talking about the underlying principle of our music called metasampling, which essentially is sampling ideas or rationales from different fields, and then by reframing them, creating new kind of system. So it is an extension of the idea of conventional sampling in hip-hop, where people take old pieces and then they chop them up and manipulating them by and then thereby creating new pieces. We do it with concept and techniques. So we will... The first operation that I did was like, okay, I'm going to use only classical techniques and only classical instruments to generate hip-hop music. In doing so, because I have no idea how, you know, hip-hop production goes, I will fail to create exact replica, but in turn, making something completely new. And this has been happening throughout throughout the emergence of black music. Jazz was like that, because if you think about jazz, piano or bass wasn't really African instrument. So this is why I think that this kind of new concert music is so important in America, because not only is it actually sort of informing the differences that we have, but also we come together and the thing that we create is brand new. And I personally really believe that that is the true vision and then the best of America.
I remember dreams of nothing but sativa and speeding along the beach with a girl from Ipanema and a beamer holding up the middle finger, the greener, where my pockets and the envious couldn't be any greener.
That was Juwan Kim of the avant-garde hip-hop orchestra Miknawoosh performing at UCSB Friday. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. When we return, we'll learn all about Central Ghost pomegranates with Father Ian Dellinger. We'll be right back.
Cleaver, sharp as a guillotine, cuz my procedure, I'm a fiend by day, Mac by night. Anybody ain't acting right to get backhanded with the black hand side.
Maybe I'll catch a break in the afterlife. My bad, that's only for folks who be acting right. I try to get my status tied. In the back of my mind, I'm trapped in a savage life. Bruised and battered, I escape to the heights of satellites, smashing lights.
Guys in the flashing lights and the badgering types with the magnum light, trying to have a fight. Asking why I'm gassing the ride to go fast in the night. Pass to the right, chasing the afterlife. I'm tired of having my sacrifice. I'm wishing I had it nice, but it ain't got after price. So I slash them lights.
You see what I see, human beings turn to fiends before they turn to teens. Police yellow tape the scene, survival at any means.
We live and we die decent on some kids trying to play and find bodies by the ravine. So,
oh yeah, I'm bitter man, I'm living like a sinner and explosive is my temperament. Hard cold is nuclear winter, damn. How did I manage to get so ugly, resemble a beast? So suddenly something inside me sick is bubbling, but I'm discovering that I'm in love with it.
Troubles are coming and hunger is number, but why do I want with the struggle for funds? Ain't nothing but it and nothing above it, and then at the run of it, none of it's fun.
Feel like I'm plummet 101, leads down into the summit. I come, they wanna see me come undone. Still all the breath up out of my lungs.
Take my breath, stealing my crumbs, telling your arm and never forgiving. Grease and bones that run with the legion, down forever indebted to demons.
Assassin be steadily scheming, fighting on having me bleeding. Beans are no longer breathing,
bloodied and muddied and heaving. What do they want from me? Ain't no more money, I don't wanna die for no reason. When you sleep in the street at the end of the evening,
you live on your knees as indecent.
Before I know it, I'm fleeing, suddenly cornered, trying to beat them back.
On the solstice of the rapture, smoking ashes, all I see it back.
I see it black, reaching at my feet are flat. I see the past reflected back in me in a trap. Scraps my teeth and gnash.
As death comes from me at last, I have no choice but to be in the past.
My life flashing past, at least I got to see some ash.
I'm about to get into me at the end of this simple life. I only be left with thirst, but pain and vengeance my only drive. So if I have to die, looking at the sky, glassy out, I have to rise. Catalyze, still collapse and rhyme. Material loss. Material loss. Material loss. Material loss.
Material loss.
Upon his entry to the underworld, the messenger Hermes was amazed at what he found. Instead of finding a frail and fearful Persephone, he found that the goddess was now queen of the dead and in charge of greeting the new arrivals and helping them adapt to their new life. While she wished to see her mother up above, she was torn by her desire to remain Hades' wife.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and rest assured, this is Playing with Food.
Hades came to his queen's side. He gently kissed her forehead and urged her, "Do not fret. Eat instead from this fruit I know you will like." As she pressed the red pomegranate seeds to her lips, she listened to his words. He told her he would miss her very much. She climbed into the chariot and bid her husband farewell as Hermes sped them off to the middle realm of Mother Earth, the home of her devoted mother.
Persephone and the pomegranate, the daughter of the Greek god Zeus and his wife Demeter, goddess of the harvest and agriculture, frolicked in the fields one day only to stumble upon a beautiful narcissus flower, which split open the earth to introduce her to Hades, god of the underworld. From that moment, Persephone became his bride. After a while, Hades promised Persephone that she could return to her mother, but alas.
The flowers sang joyfully of her return, while her mother beamed with pride. Yet she recalled a declaration Zeus had made from the heavens up above. In order for Persephone to return to the home and life she had known, the young goddess must be as pure as the day she left her mother's side. However, the ruby stain upon her lips spoke of the beauty's fate. Persephone had tasted of the fruit of life. It could not be erased.
Persephone's downfall, her Hades handcuffs, was the sweet red taste of pomegranate. And if you've ever seen and eaten one, you will understand her attraction. The amazingly bright red Mideastern fruit brightens up the dull days of late fall and early winter. I remember eating them as a child, something special and very rare. But then, one day while researching a segment of Playing with Food, I came across the most amazing flower I had ever seen.
There's these beautiful kind of bushy trees with these bright red flowers on them that I've never seen before. What is that?
These are pomegranate trees. So we have four pomegranate trees here, just a funky looking shrub. And then you start to see these little red buds form, and then comes this flower, and then the flower kind of closes up and it balloons up and hardens. And then finally you have what you recognize in the store as pomegranate. And it's just amazing to have grown up, you know, having the occasional pomegranate. And then it's a totally different experience to have actually watched that fruit grow from seemingly nothing into a full fruit that I recognize and enjoy.
That's Kenny Chisholm at Westmont College in Santa Barbara. And he's right. It's so amazing to watch this flaming red flower turn into something that I had only previously enjoyed from the grocery store. So I went on yet another quest on the Central Coast, far from the underworld, on the way to a winery in Paso Robles' west side. The side of the road was dotted with red. "Slow down!" I yelled at my Angelino driver and friend. As she slowed, I saw that the red dots were pomegranates. So I took to the internet to find the farmer, only to discover that they had ceased operations. Then, a year later, a jar of pomegranate jelly appeared with the name and contact information of the local producer.
My name is Susan Moore, and I'm the owner of Morning Glory Farms. I produce jams and jellies and some salsas and dried fruits. This is Bradley, California, probably one of the most northern parts of San Luis Obispo County. This is very rural.
And there began this journey to discover the pomegranate on a very busy road, despite being in one of the most remote spots in San Luis Obispo County. And you will hear the cars passing by.
So these are two of my trees right here. My other trees are a little smaller. Since I do source from another grower, I don't have a lot of my own. There's a couple that are almost ripe here. The pomegranate season is late fall, early winter. So a lot of them will still be green. This is what I have here. I've trained them to be more like trees so that I can get up underneath to pick.
What kind of growing conditions do they need?
They need sun. I do like to give them plenty of water. The warm summers are great for them. I don't think a frost is that good for them, but I've had frost and it hasn't hurt their flowers at all.
The flowers. If you haven't seen the flowers of a pomegranate, you must search them out in the summertime. They are truly remarkable. So I told Susan my story. Okay, so speaking of flowers, about a year and a half ago, I was doing another interview, and I came across this bright red flower that I'd never, ever seen before. And it was a color that I'd never seen in nature before. And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "That's a pomegranate."
Well, it starts out as a beautiful flower, red flower. Like you said, it has to be pollinated, and then it will start to grow into a little green pod that gets bigger and bigger. And then once it gets to the right size, it will start to turn red. Let's see. I did see there was one right above us, right over there.
Yep.
So this one's not quite ripe, as you see. Both of these, there's two right there. They'll get a little bit bigger, and then they'll turn ripe. Then I just clip them to start to process them. They will keep in your refrigerator for a couple months, you know, fresh like that. Now, if I were to clip this right now with it being green like this, the seeds inside would be white, and they will not ripen.
So it doesn't ripen off the tree?
No, it's one of the fruits that will not. Some fruits do. This is one that doesn't.
Does it taste bad when it's not ripe?
Well, it's bitter. It's bitter. It's not sweet yet. So the more water I give it, the sweeter the fruit will be.
So you planted these trees yourself?
Yes.
From clipping or from a seed?
You know, I bought them in pots.
How long does it take for it to get to its first fruit?
You know, probably, I'm trying to remember now, I've had these trees for a long time, and I think it was probably about 3 years before it had the good, big, round fruit.
Yours are shaded by another tree. Is that intentional? Like the ones on the road were right in the sun.
No, it's not intentional. This is a walnut tree, and it's just become so prolific this year. I've actually cut it back quite a bit, but I will trim it back once it's finished fruiting its walnuts.
It's not meant to be shaded like that. It just has grown that way this year. So this tree doesn't have a huge crop this year, just as my pomegranates don't have a very big crop. And I think sometimes they just rest. The last few years I've had like prolific amounts of walnuts and pomegranates. This year I don't. So trees, sometimes they just need to rest a bit. And then next year I may have a huge crop again.
The pomegranate, or at least Susan's, has an unlikely pest.
I do have squirrels that get them too, and I don't spray or use pesticides or anything. You know, it's hard to keep the birds off it as well. And I do have a woodpecker that can be invasive from time to time. That's from a woodpecker.
So woodpeckers like the pomegranates?
Mm-hmm. And they're looking for bugs as well. Yeah, he's probably trying to drink the juice, get some seeds in there.
What kind of pests do you have for the pomegranates other than woodpeckers?
We don't have any pests on them. I don't have anything that is a danger to them.
The growing is simple. You have a bush or tree, it needs sun and water, and you harvest when ripe. So let's find out what to do with the fruit. Susan makes pomegranate jelly.
So how do you use them? Obviously, you probably just eat them like they are. Do you eat the whole seed, or do you suck off the pulp off the seed?
I do it both ways. The seeds are a great source of fiber, so it's good to do it that way. I do like to suck the juice off the seeds as well. You know, I throw it in my salad from time to time. The other thing, too, is I do make jam for my business out of the pomegranates, too.
Can you do anything other than jam?
They're great for marinades, salad dressings, and sauces, things like that. I know friends who have used it as a marinade, and I think they create the marinade, and the pomegranate juice goes inside it.
Okay. Can I see what you're doing with your jam?
Yes.
Great.
Yes. So we'll have to go up to the house where I do all my processing.
Okay, great. I'll follow you up there.
Okay.
Great.
We wind up her driveway about a half mile to the farmhouse and straight into the kitchen.
So I should tell you that my kitchen, this is where I do a lot of my operation. I am a cottage bee licensed business. So I am licensed through the county to operate in my kitchen. I'm inspected once a year through the health department. I think it's a great thing to have for people to have a small business without the expense of a commercial kitchen that you would have to rent space at and everything. Cottage A is where you sell directly to the consumer. Cottage B, you can sell with a third party.
Susan wasn't actually in a position to make a batch of jelly. She hadn't harvested yet, but she talked me through the process.
This is basically what I do here. Wash them really good first. I'm going to get a bowl. So I'm going to fill it with cold water. And while that's filling, and I usually use a serrated knife because it works much quicker. So I cut the ends off like this. So those are ripe. That's great. Then I do this.
Just cut it right in half.
Mm-hmm. And I cut it in quarters like this.
But not all the way through.
Yes, just like it'll be easy to break it open. Like that. Okay. And then I just take it and I break it open like this.
Break it open in quarters.
In the water. And you just pop it open like this and the seeds will just come right off and they don't break. And they'll float to the bottom eventually. So any of the membrane that gets stuck on there will float to the top. So I basically just go through that and do that with them. So I'm getting ready to get pomegranates from that ranch and mine put together and then process it all.
So when you get the pomegranates, how many pounds of pomegranates will you be dealing with when it all shows up?
It's hard to say. It just all depends on what we have time to pick and what we can get. You know, I always go by, I don't go by pounds. I usually, the most I've ever had is about 500 pomegranates at a time.
And how long does it take you to just to get the seeds out of them?
3 days, maybe, to get through them all.
Doesn't your back hurt standing over the sink by then?
Yes.
And your hands?
Yes. Well, I get a big stool and I sit there after a while.
And who helps you?
Well, I have a lady that helps me. She and I do it together.
You have all of those seeds in bowls, I'm assuming, all over the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just start putting them through this domestic kitchen-sized juicer.
Yes, yes.
And how long does the juicing take when you have 500 pomegranates?
Oh, probably 2 days.
Okay, actually, that's not bad, but that's 2 8-hour, 10-hour, 12-hour days?
7 hours, like, okay. You know, 6 or 7 hours. And then, you know, we take breaks. My granddaughter likes to come over and help as well. She likes to operate the juicer. And then even my husband will jump in there and help me too when I need some help.
So 3 days to get the seeds off,
2 days to juice, and then you start making jam.
Yes, yes. Like I preserve what I'm not going to use at that moment. My pomegranate juice is all frozen in 4 cups, freezer bags at the moment. And that's all still from last year. So, but it still will make, you know, good jam. And then I start making batches of jam.
Making pomegranate jelly is very similar to other popular types of jam.
Pomegranate is pretty easy. I make 4 batches. I do it in fours, so 4 batches at a time. So it's a matter of, you know, measuring out the juice. You put the juice in the pot, measure out my pectin, sugar. I buy 50-gallon bags of sugar at a time. So you measure out your pectin that you need and bring it to a boil. You have to stir constantly, and then you add your measured sugar in, boil it again for a certain amount of time, and then I have my jars ready to go. I use 8-ounce jars, and I start filling the jars, the 4 batches, and we have jars laid out across the, you know, the counter there. Once they're all filled, I wipe off the rims. I have my lids ready to go, and you boil your lids for about 60 seconds, pull them out of the water, and then you start putting the lids on. From that point, when they're hand tight, I put them in boiling water. I boil them for 5 to 10 minutes. That seals them and then kills any bacteria that might be in the jar. And then you pull them out, let it cool down, and it gels at that point. And then I wash my jars and I start labeling. I try to keep this pretty stocked so I can pull for customers. People call and say, I want 3 jars of pomegranate, 2 jars of apricot. I just pull it from here. These are always ready to go.
So you're always ready to sell somebody pomegranate jelly, even though it's not pomegranate season?
Yes. I always have everything on stock. I have people that buy it for their peanut butter and jelly. I have people that use it on their bagels. They use it on their croissants. I've had a customer that was using it in their recipe for their restaurant. A customer that has a coffee shop in Ventura. He uses it on one of his sandwiches. People use it in all different ways, not just on toast. It's also great paired with a cheese on a cracker. I would probably say like a goat chevre. It would be great with that, yes.
And this all got started by accident.
I think it was like 2007. My mother and I would plant our gardens. My mother lived here with us. I grew up with her canning and making jams. And so one year we had such a prolific garden that we did a bunch of jams and canning. And we went to a country fair at Bryson Hesperia. Passed here about another 20 minutes up in the mountains, and I got a little ad on it. I said, well, let's just go set up a table and see what we can sell. Well, we sold out, and people asked for more and more and more. So it just turned into a business. We worked it as a business up until about 3 years ago when my mother retired from the business. So now I do it on my own, and I have a couple of people that work for me.
So it was my turn to play with pomegranates. Here's what it was like. From pinching, I mean picking, to pulping, to partaking. I'm back at the pomegranates at the side of the road. They're actually harder to pick than I thought. Lots of cars going by. But these are bright red. Try to get some pomegranates. Here's a nice one. Beautiful red. Okay, let me get 2 more. There we go. I've got a bag full of pomegranates. So I have this big pile of pomegranates that I picked from the side of the road, and I'm gonna process most of them into juice. I'm gonna do exactly what Susan told me, and I'm gonna partially quarter them and then take out the seeds underwater. So this first one I opened isn't ripe because the seeds are still white. There's a little pink on them, but they're mostly still white. The next one I open, all the seeds are red, and I'm just gonna peel away like she told me to, underwater. I'm gonna do about 15 of these pomegranates.
I got about 2 cups of seeds from about 14 pomegranates, but that's not quite accurate. About half the pomegranates were not ripe. The seeds were white when I broke open the pomegranates. So that was really disappointing because I got the brightest, reddest pomegranates I could find on the trees. I did notice when I was picking some of them that where the stem of the pomegranate attaches to the tree was a little bit drier than others and they were easier to remove. And that's typical of fruit being ripe. And so I tried to get those fruits, but clearly I wasn't successful. So I feel really bad that I wasted some fruit that can't be harvested by other people or animals. I'm going to take these 2 cups of pomegranates. I'm going to put them through my food mill to see if I can get some juice out of them. So I've added some pomegranate seeds to the food mill, and let's see if the food mill will work like Susan's juicer. So there's this pulp and there's this pink liquid. Ooh, it's nice. It tastes like pomegranate. I was going to make 2 dishes with my fresh pomegranate juice. One was a Middle Eastern dish with lentils and pomegranate juice. And then another was Brussels sprouts with a pomegranate glaze. However, with the disappointing amount of juice that I got, I decided to just do a taste test. So I bought 2 things. This juice that is 100% mangosteen juice plus pomegranate. I don't know what mangosteen fruit is, but we'll give it a try. And then I bought a jar of 100% pomegranate juice from concentrate. So I'm going to try the mangosteen and pomegranate. There's not much to it. It's just kind of a sweet, nondescript juice. Then I'm going to try my juice. It's actually quite nice. It's a lovely juice, and it'd be great mixed with soda water, which I might even do. Let's try this pomegranate juice from concentrate. It's very different. It tastes darker and deeper. It actually tastes like grape juice, and I think I actually prefer the pomegranate juice that I got from my pomegranates, because this other pomegranate juice genuinely tastes like grape juice. The fresh pomegranate juice was by far the best way to enjoy it. Everything fresh is better. I've used pomegranate molasses in Middle Eastern cooking, and it's definitely worth giving that a try. Though, I would say that, however few bushes there are, it's easier to find a fresh pomegranate on the Central Coast than pomegranate molasses. I did pour my juice into some sparkling water, and that made for a refreshing mid-autumn drink. Like Susan said,
it's very delicious. It's very healthy for you. Pomegranate jelly is something that you can't necessarily find in a grocery store. When you find someone like me who makes it, it's just a real treat.
Seek out the fresh pomegranate this and every autumn. You will feel rewarded as you press the red pomegranate seeds to your lips. Fortunately, we do not have to worry about the fate of Persephone befalling us.
Persephone had tasted of the fruit of life. It could not be erased. Even so, Zeus loved his daughter too much to send her back to Hades without the hope of returning to her mother's abode above. So each spring, Persephone comes back with the flowers that pave her way to tell the story of rebirth, hope, and harmony. And each fall, when she leaves again for the underworld below, her mother mourns and winter comes while she waits for her return. The Myth of Persephone, Greek Goddess of the Underworld. Original story and interpretation by Laura Strong, PhD.
This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.